It's the Marketplace Tech Podcast for Tuesday, the 23rd. I'm Ben Johnson in New York. Maybe you've heard of the service Instacart, where you can have people buy your groceries for you and then get them delivered to your house. The company now says it will treat contractors as part-time employees on the heels of a court case in California where an Uber driver won the right to be treated as an employee. It's an interesting change. Our friend Lindsay Turrentine has been thinking about this. Lindsay, what are the details?
Instacart has done a pilot program in a couple of cities, including Boston and Chicago, to take the in-store shoppers, the people who actually do the grabbing of items off the shelf, making them employees, regular employees of Instacart, rather than contract workers who don't get benefits. Instacart is not going to be making employees of drivers or shoppers who also drive the deliveries to the door.
I know the company has said that this is really about better productivity and not about fear of lawsuits. But is this part of a larger trend that we may be on the very bleeding edge of, where we see some of these sharing economy, so to speak, companies think about giving better benefits to their employees to protect themselves in several ways?
You know that Uber has, in California at least, lost a suit in which it's now being told that at least one of its many, many drivers needs to be treated as an employee. I think that this is going to keep happening because an entire economy built on contractors who have to provide all of their own infrastructure is probably not a very stable one.
Lindsay Turrentine, editor-in-chief at CNET.com. Lindsay, nice to have you as always.
Thank you, Ben.
The author John Steinbeck said that the art of story writing couldn't be passed around like a recipe from one person to another. But did he account for Amazon's massive data trove? The e-commerce giant says it is now going to pay royalties to self-publishing authors on its Kindle Direct Publishing program by the number of pages read by the user. Peter Wehner is an author who wrote about this for The Atlantic. Hi, Peter.
Hello.
What's prompting this per-page payout system here?
I think Amazon loves to experiment. So they have one mechanism which allows people to kind of pay per month, kind of like Netflix for books. And the people who wrote big, thick books were saying it's not fair to pay us the same amount as the thin books. And I think Amazon looked at that and said, let's turn the crank one more turn, and now they're going to just pay per page to make everything really fair.
Really? You definitely believe that's their only reasoning at this point?
I think that's the start of it, but I think you're absolutely correct that there are all these other angles that they've got to be aware of.
What about for writers? How are writers reacting to this move?
If you're great at kind of producing these kind of spellbinding thriller-type books that keep people turning the pages, then this is right up your alley. But if you want to write something that's a little bit tauter, you know, something that maybe has people put the book down for a second and contemplate for a half hour before they move to the next page, well, that's not so good. You know, you look around and people aren't buying books as often. And so when you have these kind of complicated books that maybe help us move our thought along, I don't think we have a good funding mechanism for it. And I think this kind of undermines the traditional one.
Peter Wehner is an author, a writer, and a programmer based in Baltimore, Maryland. He wrote about Amazon's new policy of paying self-published authors per page in The Atlantic. Peter, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much for having me.
Marketplace Tech is listener-supported. To keep our coverage relevant and compelling, please make a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace today. Please, your gift in any amount counts twice thanks to a dollar-for-dollar match from Newman's Own Foundation. Help us keep you up to date and well-informed wherever you are. Donate at marketplace.org by June 30th. All this week, we are reporting a series about technology in prisons called Jailbreak. Today's conversation is about the growing use of video visitation in prisons. It's being used already in over 500 institutions around the country. Most of them are county jails, but a few are state prisons. And while we know a lot about the impact of in-person visits between inmates and their loved ones while incarcerated, we don't know much about the impact of video visitation. Bernadette Raboy is at the Prison Policy Initiative and has been studying this. Bernadette, why has there been such a growth of video visits in prisons?
The main reason is to cut down on costs. So the way that it's marketed to them by private companies is that by using video visitation, they won't have to pay corrections officers to transport incarcerated people from their housing units to a central visitation room. A secondary reason is contraband. The facilities say that they can reduce the amount of contraband that gets into the jails and prisons. But the main reason is really to cut costs.
And I'm assuming the companies that we're talking about here that work with prisons are not Skype, FaceTime, etc.?
So the leader in this market is Securus Technologies. Some of the other ones are IC Solutions, Telmate, just other companies that are in the phones market. Because the way that video is usually added is it's added as an extra benefit to a phones contract.
Tell me about how a video visitation works. What are the steps here for families and for inmates?
Right. So there's two options. The first is a remote video chat. And then the other option is at the facility. So what happens is the family takes the time and expense to travel to a jail or prison. They're often in the same building as their incarcerated loved one, but they have a visit with a computer screen.
So what's the ideal model here? Is it some sort of combination of in-person stuff and video visitation?
The ideal model is to have those in-person visits available and then to have those remote video chats available for families as well. For example, if they are far away, this trend keeps on growing, and yet we don't know that these video visits are equivalent to in-person visits, which have been shown by a lot of research to be one of the only ways we know for sure reduces the likelihood of future crimes.
Bernadette Raboy is at the Prison Policy Initiative. Bernadette, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You can find more information on our Jailbreak series all week at MarketplaceTech.org. I'm Ben Johnson, and that's our show today. This is APM.